Welcome to 20 Minute Tabletop, a podcast about board, card and miniatures games, where each week we discuss something that excites us in the hobby in 20 minutes or less. And this week we're going to look at our favourite games from our own childhoods and what we're playing now that we have our own children.
I mean, technically I should add that we don't have our own children, Kev, as much as we're close. I'm sure if we did, we'd have a lovely family board games most evenings. It would be quite a sweet scene that you've described there.
Yeah, I think it would be lovely.
But yes, we're going to talk about some of our early gaming. And obviously, you heard a little bit about my childhood experiences of Space Crusade last week. And I thought it would be nice to follow that on, really, to talk about maybe some of the games you played, Kev, as a kid. And also how we are playing slightly different games with our own children in 2024. So yeah, should we crack on with that then?
Yeah, let's get stuck in. So where did it all start for you, Tom?
You know, the standard games that everybody plays, Monopoly, Cluedo, Risk. I loved Mastermind, strangely. Did you ever play Mastermind where you get five or six colours at the end?
Yeah, I remember it, and I really remember the little plastic pieces and really quite a strange piece of artwork for a children's game. Just kind of the old guy. I've forgotten his name. Magnus, possibly.
Yeah.
In the chair on the front of the box. Yeah, really quite a serious look for a child's game.
You see, I love that game because I used to play it with my uncle. And what he used to do is he used to narrate his thinking process during the game. So he'd say, ah, interesting. Well, there's a lot of green in this room. So I think subconsciously you may be thinking about having some green in there. And I've noticed that when I said green, your eyes twinkled a little bit, so maybe. And then I played that game with my wife, Jo, and she sat there in silence the entire game, and it was the most dull game I'd ever played in existence. So I did enjoy Mastermind.
That's actually a genius bit of teaching from your uncle, grandfather, was it? In that he's, you know, talking it out aloud, and I'm sure we'll get into the intricacies of introducing these games to children, because we probably all want to get Scythe out with the kids, you know, and you've got a three-year-old sat in front of a four-hour epic, Twilight Imperium. It's just not happening as much as you want it to. I think as a parent, you've got to be quite patient. But for me, it started probably with the usual classics, you know, the Ludo and the Snakes and Ladders and all that kind of stuff. The first two games that I remember were quite big pieces of plastic. There's one called Ghost Castle by Milton Bradley, if you remember that one.
Absolutely. I loved Ghost Castle. What a game that was. In fact, they've just re-released it. Did you know that?
No way. I hope it has a an expansion box and it's available for £500 from Kickstarter with all the extras.
No, it's, I tell you what, it's really, really good. The production values that they've done of this game. I bought it for the kids for Christmas, not last year, but the year before. The worst thing about it, though, is when you've constructed Ghost Castle and this new edition, you will never get it back in the box. And it's ostensibly the same game, and they've done a really good job of bringing it back to life. Because I used to search in charity shops for Ghost Castle, you know, because it did become a real collectible piece, didn't it? What a game that was.
I know, I had it. I bought it from a charity shop as an adult, looked on eBay for a missing piece and found that my incomplete set sold for £50.
Yeah.
So it went back on eBay. I've got to say, but it is a great thing. But I loved anything that was big and plastic, really. So Mousetrap was another classic. I really ought to introduce these to my kids rather than trying to, you know, get the really complex hobby games to the table. There was another one called Dinosaur. I think it was Dinosaur Island, where there was an enormous brown plastic volcano in the middle of it. And then you laid little lava tiles, and that was like the in-game clock. And then it was ostensibly just roll the dice, get the dinosaurs around the track before the lava comes. But any kind of big showy thing, Mousetrap with the moving mechanism, Dinosaur Island, Ghost Castle with a big castle that you drop the skull down, I was all in for that kind of thing.
Was it Fireball Island? Because I know that's just been re-released. Or was it definitely have dinosaurs in it?
I'm sure it had dinosaurs in it. But again, I'm maybe misremembering it. It had dinosaurs in my imagination anyway.
Talking about ostentatious pieces of plastic, I used to have Battle Masters, which was, I didn't realise, it was a Milton Bradley plus Warhammer collaboration, and it came with a sheet. Are you familiar with the game?
Yeah, I remember. It was an enormous box, wasn't it? With big, expansive pictures on the back of it. I always wanted it, never got it, though.
You literally laid out this plastic mat over your entire bedroom floor. It was enormous. It was the kind of game that I always wanted my dad to play with me, but now as an adult, I recognise that you're crouching on a bedroom floor. You know, this isn't a game you sat around a table. You had to be lying down for 90% of it. So I spent most of my time playing Battle Masters on my own. Did you have HeroQuest and Space Crusade?
I did, although I had HeroQuest, not Space Crusade. I was very much more into the fantasy games, but I think that probably was inspired, and my lifelong love of kind of fantasy miniatures games probably come from two game systems. The first one was Crossbows and Catapults, if you remember that. That's just been re-released. There's obviously some nostalgia thing going on, all these great 80s massive plastic games. But Crossbows and Catapults, if you remember it, you had two castles at either end of the map, and then you literally had crossbows and catapults that sent big pieces of plastic across your living room, and you had to try and knock down the other person's castle. And you built a little wall. There was Vikings, I think. My friend had one with a longboat expansion, where there was Viking longboats that fired pieces of plastic. Oh, it was awesome. So that was kind of a loosely fantasy vibe. But the thing that started it for me, 100%, was I got some Top Trump cards, which I'm sure is a worldwide phenomenon. Now we've got worldwide listeners, Tom. But if this is not a thing in your country, basically Top Trump's pictures of cars, animals, whatever, with some stats on, and the two players compare the stats, and then the one with the best stats keeps the pile. Once you've got more cards than your opponent, you win. And I had a Games Workshop issue. I think I got it from, it was my birthday, and another child bought me at the party. Games Workshop combat cards, and I had the Chaos and Orcs, and he had the actual pictures of the miniatures from Games Workshop, the Citadel miniature range as it was. And I've looked these up, and you can imagine it's going for quite a lot of money on eBay now. But it was literally just the stat lines out of the Warhammer Fantasy Battles manual printed onto the cards, the most low-effort product ever. And I absolutely loved it. And then, you know, years later in WH Smith's, which is like our big stationers magazine shop, saw White Dwarf, which was the Games Workshop magazine, with the black and white pictures of all the catalogue in the back. And that was it. I was hooked. That was way too expensive. So HeroQuest, genius bit of marketing from Games Workshop and MB, released it, and then I was in. I loved HeroQuest, probably as much as you love Space Crusade.
You see, I would argue that I love HeroQuest just as much, if not more, than Space Crusade. I they're on a par for me, but HeroQuest probably... a little bit higher. My dwarf in HeroQuest, by the way, has got a little bit of an adventure that I haven't told people about. Even though it was my childhood game, HeroQuest, it was a game that was enjoyed by my dad and my mum. And when my uncle and auntie came to stay once, and my uncle played as the wizard, and at the end of the game, he killed my mum, who was playing as the dwarf, because you can, you know, attack your friendly figures, can't you? Just so he could have all the treasure. And my mum was so upset by it that she picked up my dwarf and lobbed it into the open fire. So my dad rescued this dwarf. But even to this day, it's got slight deformation. And that's why I've never been tempted, you know, to, because obviously it's been re-released, HeroQuest, and everybody's talking about it. And I'd never be tempted to upgrade, because I like the fact that this was the game that I played as a kid. I think that matters to me, even though it shouldn't matter too much.
A little hallmark of the family violence, Christmas time family violence. That sounds great. I remember playing that with my dad. Obviously, I got it for Christmas. Unlike you, I was an only child, so my dad played it. I think we got through the first campaign. The first story. That was pretty much it. I think he was not into it. But my dad had a ZX Spectrum, so he was ostensibly a geek in his own way in the 70s and 80s. And he had the Hobbit text adventure, which I don't know whether he bought it. He used to buy the ZX Spectrum magazine and copy the code out at the back. They used to give a game away. But the way they would give the game away with the magazine was they would just print the code and you had to copy it out line by line. Either way, he had the Hobbit text adventure and he used to load that up for me. And I absolutely loved it. I must have been 4 or 5 years old, hardly able to read, but then you get the low, not even low poly, pixel art of the Hobbit's doorway. And now, actually, I'm reading The Hobbit with my lad, Ted, who's 7, who's just coming into his own world of games, although perhaps not as fast as I like. I need to be more patient.
Yeah, we're supposed to be talking about board games, but I do remember a text adventure game on the Commodore 64, and I couldn't get past the very first screen, and it was the most frustrating game I'd ever played. I was trying every command, you know, eat the seagull, remove a stone, jump up and down, tap at the door, you know, and I'd never got past it. And it was way before I remember back in the day, you had to phone up a company, didn't you? I got so much trouble once playing Zelda and phoning up for help from a magazine. And it must have cost about 50 quid or whatever to my parents. They were livid that I'd been on the waiting list for an hour to find out. But anyway, yeah, other childhood games for me. I played the really nasty horse racing game, which is still in print and still you'll see in WH Smith's. It's a horse racing game with gambling and betting and a very, very low board game geek rating. Although as a child, it did all the things I needed it to do. And probably the best game I accidentally played as a child was the 1979 Spiel des Jahre winner, Hare and Tortoise, which is a racing game, but without dice. You spend carrots to move, and there is chance in it, but you will decide if you want to take a chance. So you can play the entire game without chance, and it's all about moving backwards to gain carrots or moving forwards. And it was brilliant. I still think it would stand up as a game, you know, and that hopefully the Spiel des Jahre title. I mean, I know that it was sort of 40, 50 years old now, but it was really good. I presumably have not heard of that one.
No, I have heard of the really nasty horse racing game, because that results in family arguments big time, doesn't it? You know, it's known yeah. for it. But that one sounds excellent. You know, I've got to say, in preparing for this podcast, I was, you know, prepared to go in with the lines of, oh, weren't old games rubbish? You know, the things we played, and look at the amazing range. But actually, there were some absolute bangers back in the day. And I think,
yeah, there really was.
You know, the memories they create, like you were saying in your Space Crusade podcast, are much more important than the actual, you know, mechanics of what's going on.
Yeah.
In that. So, I mean, what are you playing with your kids at the moment? Because yours are a little bit older than mine. So I've got Max, who's 5, and Ted, who's 7. So obviously quite a bit younger than your guys. So you're able to play some real games in inverted commas now, aren't you?
Yeah, and you were kind of teasing it before a little bit, in the sense that I'm a bit like you. I've never gone down the realm of my little Carcassonne or my little Everdell or my little Catan, because there's a new market now, isn't there, for games designed to replicate, you know, the proper board game, but for children. And I've never done that with mine. And I probably should. And I only learned that I probably should with the game Queen Domino, which is part of the King Domino universe. And Queen Domino is up in complexity on King Domino. Neither game is particularly complex, but it's more complex. But I just happened to see Dragomino, which is the child version of King Domino. And I bought it for my son, who's 6, who will regularly play Century Spice Road, regularly play Azul. Splendor is his favourite game. He asked for Splendor Duel for his birthday. But I gave him Dragomino, and for the first time in my life, I felt almost guilty, because it was such a simple game and he was in such a happy little space, you know. And I was thinking, oh God, the poor soul that I've kind of been asking to read cards, and he kind of makes his own game within it. I mean, he's very good at Century Spice Road and Azul, you know. But I did feel that I maybe had misjudged the kind of level of games. But it's difficult as well when you've got kids of a different age,
to try and find something in the middle. I mean, it's the same thing with Lego to an extent. You know, I like the idea of building some complicated Lego Technic thing with my lad, who was maybe 5 at the time. And with an enormous amount of help, you can do it. But the age rating is so that the child can enjoy it on their own. That's how I think. I think it's probably the same with board games. In fact, I've got a video, one of a really sort of lovely video from when Ted was 3. And I just got Too Many Bones Undertow, and I was learning to play it solo, and obviously wants to come see what his dad was doing. And the game was, we rolled the dice, and if the bones showed, we both shouted, "Too many bones," and he loved it. And that was the game. We just ignored the rules, played that, did that for hours. It was a fantastic time. But yeah, I think the temptation to go deep into the complicated thing is one that you've really got to resist, especially with the age range. Physical games are the favourites in our household at the moment. So things like Jungle Speed Safari, if you're familiar with that one.
I certainly am. Yeah, I've got 4 copies of Jungle Speed, Kev, because every time I see Jungle Speed in a charity shop, which is quite frequently, or a car boot sale, I always buy a copy, because it tends to be just a couple of couple of pounds. And then when I do play Jungle Speed in a you know, in a party style situation, people always go, oh, this is brilliant. And I go, there's a box, have it. You know, you can have that.
No, it's fantastic. It's brilliantly suited to not only children, but also drunk people, I found. Because for those who haven't heard of the game, basically there's five different coloured mushrooms or pillars, little wooden blocks with pictures of different animal foods on. But the animal foods are not the colour you'd expect. So you'd expect the blue fish, red meat. They've mixed up the colours. So it just screws your brain over enough that when from the top of the deck you take a picture of a giraffe, you go to grab the green leaf, but actually the green leaf, the green block, might be the blue fish or the red meat or whatever. So basically everyone's playing at the same time and trying to grab the pieces of the game. And that kind of physical, not at all thinky, works with children of different ages, I think.
And as you say, drunken humans, that will work as well.
Yeah.
It was interesting what you said about like going slightly too deep into a game with children, because I, for the first time in my life, have experienced the opposite, which is foolishly, and this was a mistake, I bought my eldest son a copy of the starter set for Dungeons & Dragons, and little did I know that that would then result into him listening to over 50 hours of Critical Role podcast, you know, at night time. It's a little bit adult, but, you know, he is. Anyway, I'm not going to justify some bad parenting decisions. I'll just broadcast them across the world, and that's fine. And he also spends a lot of time on D&D Beyond, and he's desperate to play Dungeons & Dragons with me. And I've started calling it Dungeons & Admin, because I have to spend ages, you know, working out what's going to happen. And the starter set's relatively light, but you are having to spend a long time kind of understanding the map, what happens unless you want a stop-start game. And of course, because he knows the rules so much better than me, you know, it does actually mean that we can play it, because he will say, no, Dad, in this kind of scenario, or he'll give me little tips like, no, you're not supposed to say what we can do, you're supposed to narrate some choices. And I was like, all right, yeah, fair enough. I have actually, just for fun, because he wanted to learn how to edit, recorded a few copies of some of the sessions that we did. Don't worry, I'm not going to drop one in here. But so it was kind of the opposite. I had the experience of, rather than trying to get my kids to play a too complicated game, I felt like the person out of his depth playing with my sort of 11-year-old with Dungeons & Dragons. Is that a game you've played, Dungeons & Dragons, by the way?
I've done a one-shot, and it's, I don't know, I'm a little bit possibly too self-conscious for it, I think. You know, go to the gaming centre and you hear people, you know, doing the voices. And I know it doesn't have to be that, but for whatever reason, I find it difficult just to abstract myself, the game and the story. But, you know, to each their own, and it does look like a lot of fun. But I think maybe games like that, the idea that you're developing and changing a character is a big draw. And obviously, with, like, computer games and things, you can upgrade a character. That's a massive draw. And you introduced me to Star Realms. And my eldest, 7, absolutely loves Star Realms. The idea that, you know, you start off with a base, it's a deck builder set in space, and you have a fleet of ships, very, very basic, and then you, in the usual deck building style, you pick up new ships and improve your fleet. And he loved the idea of buying upgrades. We played Jaws of the Lion together. I did most of the rules overhead, the heavy lifting on the rules. He kind of just made the decisions. But the best bit for him was getting to, you know, buy a better sword or spend some gold coins on some faster boots or whatever. That is where it's at, I think.
And in fact, that's where it was at in Hero Quest, incidentally, wasn't it? Back in the 80s, that even they had that kind of understanding of leveling up between levels, between campaigns as well.
Yeah, I think you could really buy spells and things. Yeah, I have a vision of like a kind of a genie that looked a little bit like a guy blowing out a candle. But yeah, it was all kind of line art, wasn't it? With weird brown ink style. But yeah, strong memories from Hero Quest.
I feel the need to caveat the fact that I have had some wonderful times playing Dungeons & Dragons with some adults and with the kids. You know, it just isn't a game that I can just grab whack on a table and do a session. And in a busy adult life, you know, to prep for an hour before you're playing for an hour is sometimes just doesn't feel that viable as an option. But when I have done it, it's been great. It's been really, really great.
It's a real skill, isn't it, DMing, I think. And yeah, I think you get out what you put in, very much so in that world.
I do think that kids get really good, like other forms of literacy, if they've played enough games, like you're talking about Star Realms there, which my children enjoy as well. As soon as they learn little core mechanics from games like Star Realms, you can introduce a slightly more complicated game where they go, oh yeah, no, it's just like Star Realms, or it's just like this particular game. And their literacy levels kind of rise really, really quickly from being introduced to games early enough.
Yeah, in fact, you know, talking of literacy, I know you're talking in familiarity with the rules, but in terms of reading, obviously this stuff is brilliant for young children, and games that have been popular in our household with Ted, more than me, to be honest with you, is the Pokemon trading card game. Played loads of that when he was just learning to read, and I think it leveled him up pretty quickly with his reading. That's not something I hugely enjoyed. I play loads of trading card games and living card games. For whatever reason, I just couldn't click with Pokemon. I never really liked it as a kid. But it was fantastic to see him develop the love of that game. You think, you know, one day I'm going to be sitting down, opening up some kind of massive three-hour epilogue on a Saturday. It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, and obviously it's important, isn't it, to introduce our children to the endorphin rush of opening packs of cards early days so that they can be hooked in for the rest of their lives as well. You know, because I did the same with Magic the Gathering with my son, and it was really interesting. You know, he'd walk past a shop and you could see him thinking, I want to buy it. And we only did it for a short period of time, you know, before I thought this isn't actually that healthy in a way, because he would have that buzz. He would open the cards and he would look, scroll through them, but the whole thing was maybe 5 minutes of pleasure, you know, like the sensors in his brain, and then the cards were going away. And of course, you know, sometimes you draw one that was good or whatnot, but most of the time it was just forgotten after the moment of doing that. Not that I'm criticizing, you know, that field of gaming. It's just my experience of it.
Not a cheap habit. Well, as the Tolarian Community College says, you know, one of the big magic YouTube channels, is buy singles. You know, cracking packs opens great for drafting, but it's not at all an economical way of getting good cards. But yeah, it's still great fun though. There's in fact a format of Magic, pretty niche I think, called Pack Wars, where you buy a couple. And it's a super stripped down version. You just play with what's in the pack. So it's like one pack versus one pack. And it's just to kind of extend that 5 minutes of pleasure into maybe 8.5 minutes of pleasure. But you need every every pound we need. And Tom, I know we are talking about opening packets of Magic the Gathering cards here, for goodness sake.
I'll tell you what's also really good about gaming with kids is that there's some genres of games that didn't exist when we were little nippers. I can still see you're tickled by that. Cooperative games is something that we didn't have access to. And actually, some of my favourite games that I've played with the boys or watched them play, actually, separate to me, is games where they have been able to work together and towards a common goal. One of the games that they've really enjoyed, which I think is like a training ground for Pandemic, really, because it offers a lot of the same kind of mechanics, is called Ghost Fighting Treasure Hunters. And one of the things they love about that is set in a haunted house. It's got great little components, little plastic ghosts and little haunting figures. The worst thing about it is a roll and move game. So if you are rolling sixes all the way through this game, you're more likely to do well. But the kids don't really notice that, and all they have to do is go around into these houses, and every round there's more ghosts being added, so some of them are trying to bat down the ghosts, some of them are trying to collect jewels, and these little minifigures that they move around have got backpacks, and when they get a jewel they can put it in the backpack, take it out of the game. And obviously when they succeed at the game, they succeed together, you know. And it's really nice to have genres of games that they can play which is encouraging cooperation and teamwork rather than learning how to lose gracefully. which I also think is a good skill.
Yeah, that is a key skill, isn't it? And it, I've really noticed it come on as the boys have got older. They've got much better at it, thankfully. But yeah, the co-op thing, I absolutely, that really resonates with me. The Tiny Epic Zombies is a similar kind of feel to that. You've got little item meeples where you can physically equip the meeples with a shotgun or a baseball bat. You know, they absolutely love it. And that's, again, co-op. Everyone plays against a board game. So that's really good. So we need to be starting wrapping up now. So if we were to pick some mechanics or themes or ideas that make the ideal child's board game, what kind of stuff would you be looking at? I think a physical aspect. So like you were saying, little gems that go in the backpack, little shotguns that go on the meeples. What other kind of stuff you're looking at, Tom?
Well, I think the game that kind of embodies all of it for me, all of those things, is a game called Zombie Kids Evolution, which is one of the best games that my kids have ever played. It's cooperative. The concept is simple. It plays in 10 minutes as well. So the attention span is brilliant for kids. It's short enough. You've got to save a school from some cartoon-like zombies, but it's a legacy game. So every time you play a round of that game, you will get some stickers. Whether you win or lose, you will progress along this sticker chart. And when you get to certain numbers on these stickers, there are like 15 envelopes in this box, and they get to open these envelopes. And these envelopes will either make the zombies more aggressive and give the zombies new powers, which is terrifying for the kids, or the character that they've been playing with all the way through the game suddenly gets a new weapon to play with, which levels them up. And it is amazing. Not only that, as they open up these envelopes, they get little stickers that create a comic book as well. So there's a narrative that is added to incrementally through the game. If you're looking to pick that game up, make sure you get the right version. I believe there was originally released in about 2013, 2011, and then they made a legacy game version of it in 2018. Recently, it was so successful, I think, they've released one called Zombie Teens Evolution as well, and a very, very similar game. I do own both. It just so happens that Zombie Teens was probably just as good as Zombie Kids, but the kids had their fill with that kind of space. They got about three quarters of the way through, and it was brilliant. They loved it, but I suppose the original magic was when they first experienced that for the first time. So to answer your question directly, I think you need a quick playthrough. You need lots and lots of feedback and emotional success triggers. A bit like, you know, when you play Mario as a kid and you jump on the flag at the end of the game and then there's big explosions and whatnot. And then you're like, right, go again. That was amazing. Next level. I want to feel like that. So I do think kids need that kind of feedback as well. What do you think kind of encapsulates a great kids game?
I think the physical aspect, short playtime, like you said, particularly one that you introduced me to again was Escape the Temple. That was really good because it's a bit of a multimedia affair. You you know, you have to simultaneously roll dice to get out of the temple, and there's quite a spooky soundtrack that goes, well, spooky by a five-year-old standards. In fact, too spooky. And if you go on YouTube, there's a Yakety Sax version. So you can play as Benny Hill, and it really, I think that lifts the board game to another level. So I think silliness as well is good, because I love mathematic games. You know, the boys have sat with me pulling your favourite pastime, pulling tokens out of the chaos bag, you know, but to be honest, they're bored after 5 minutes because the theme doesn't grab them. So yeah, I think all these things roll together. I think maybe we should come up with some at Tom and do a Kickstarter.
Yeah, that would be a massive failure. So let's do that. That'd be great. So if we are rounding up, I probably should just finish by saying the usual spiel about sharing the podcast if you've enjoyed it. This was slightly longer form than we'd normally do. We're kind of breaking past the 30-minute mark here, but it was bound to happen eventually. It was just a matter of time. Likes on Spotify or reviews on Apple would be great. I think last time I had a look, we had 7 likes on Spotify. So if we could hit double figures, that would make my day and make Kev's day, who's smiling at me through the phone there. So yeah, thank you very much for listening. Hopefully you've enjoyed the podcast today. And we will be back next week. We release every single Tuesday. So we'll be back talking about something else next week. Thanks again.
See you in the next one.